Good evening. Tonight, we've learned that the former president is making a new effort to subvert justice and stymie the investigation into his attempt to stay in office by subverting democracy. He's reportedly doing it by invoking executive privilege in the House investigation of the attack on the Capitol, which he incited. We'll talk to former White House counsel John Dean if he can actually do that. Meantime, his allies are also still trying to undermine democracy and lay the groundwork for overturning the next election. That's the news tonight, which comes after a day that began with the Senate Judiciary Committee publishing its report on the former president's attempts to overturn the 2020 election. The title is Subverting Justice.
We were a half step away from a constitutional crisis, a full-blown constitutional crisis.
That's Committee Chairman Dick Durbin, and he's understating it. The report is the most comprehensive account we have so far of what, if we were talking about it happening anyplace but here, would be described as a coup attempt. A coup attempt is seen through the eyes of some of the people in the room, in the Oval Office even, as key decisions were made in the effort leading up to the attack on the Capitol to overturn the will of the American people. Now, one of nine attempts to pressure the Justice Department to undermine the election. Yet, as horrifying as the details are, and the attack was, it may still be tempting to file it away as just another collection of the latest in a series of such horrifying accounts. We've all gotten pretty numb to it, and that's understandable, but it's certainly a mistake. It's not like reading William Shire's Rise and Fall of the Third Reich when it first came out in 1960, safe in the knowledge that the monster had been slain. As we'll discuss tonight, there has been no fall. There is very much a live and real-time threat, a clear and present danger. That's because the enablers are still enabling and gaslighting.
So President Trump assembled a bunch of people in his office, and they discussed what they ought to do.
That's Senator Chuck Grassley, ranking Republican on the Judiciary Committee, whose members put out a rebuttal to the majority report. He's misleadingly describing a meeting in the Oval Office on the 3rd of January, a meeting we just learned happened 3 days before the Capitol attack, more than a month after then-Attorney General Barr declared there had been no widespread fraud in the election, also after dozens and dozens of courtroom losses on election fraud claims. Now, at the meeting, Barr's replacement, Acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen, also present, justice official and Trump ally Jeffrey Clark, whom the former president wanted to replace Rosen with. Reading from the report, according to Rosen, Trump opened the meeting by saying, "One thing we know is you, Rosen, aren't going to do anything to overturn the election." Now, again, this is that, and I assume he was saying that in a negative way. Again, this is an election the courts, Republican, state officials, and the president's own handpicked attorney general had already said was clean. According to the report, Rosen told the former president the department, quote, "can't and won't just flip a switch and change the election." Incredible. Then, according to committee testimony from Department of Justice second-in-command Richard Donahue, quote, "Trump asked that DOJ, Department of Justice, just say the election was corrupt and leave the rest to me and the Republican congressman," whom Donahue understood to be the Republican House members who would be challenging the Electoral College certification on January 6. He was rebuffed, thank goodness. The meeting went on for up to 3 hours. Only at the end, after being presented with the prospect of mass resignations at Justice Department if he replaced Rosen with Clark, did the former president actually relent. And nowhere, not found in one bit of testimony about the moment, did he say, "We're not doing this because it would be wrong. Of course we're not doing this because it would be wrong." His only complaint, according to Richard Donahue, is about not being able to pull it off. Now, look at Senator Grassley's take on the former president's conduct there and throughout the affair. It's posted on his website, and I'm quoting now, "The available evidence shows that President Trump did what we'd expect a president to do on an issue of this importance. He listened to his senior advisors and followed their advice and recommendations." That is rewriting history. And if any reminder were needed that today's majority report is more about today and tomorrow than the past, here's some more gaslighting today from Republican Congressman Andy Biggs.
Who won the election in Arizona? Donald Trump?
We don't know, because as the audit, it demonstrates very clearly, Mr. Raskin, there are a lot of issues with this election that took place.
I mean, that's just complete bull. It's amazing that person is a sitting congressman. I mean, that person is just lying. It's become so normal, hasn't it? It's just incredible to me. Congressman Biggs is one of several lawmakers being looked at by the House Select Committee for his role in the former president's rally which preceded the attack on the Capitol. The committee issued more subpoenas today. Meantime, four of his former top aides and allies are facing a midnight deadline to turn over documents to the committee. So, no, none of this is history yet. And sadly, it is still current events. For more on the subpoenas, I want to go to CNN's Ryan Nobles at the Capitol. So what do we know right now? What's going on?
Well, Anderson, today the Select Committee issuing a round of subpoenas to a new group of individuals, and these are people that were connected to the Stop the Steal organization, which planned and organized the Stop the Steal rally, which served as the prelude, of course, to the insurrection here at the Capitol on January 6th. The two men in particular who they're looking for documents from and an interview and deposition of is Ale Alexander and Nathan Martin. Now, Alexander in particular is an interesting figure. He was very popular on the conservative far-right internet, and he is someone who also has publicly boasted about his direct and personal connections with three members of Congress, among them Paul Gosar, Mo Brooks, and the man you were just talking about, Andy Biggs, who have been long perpetuators of the big lie, also people that voted to object to the election results, and played some role in that Stop the Steal rally ahead of what happened here on January 6th. So this does give us some insight into what the committee is looking for. They're looking for coordination, planning, and organization around that rally, and then how it could have enabled or led to the violence and chaos here at the Capitol on that day.
So what exactly is the former president telling his allies to do in regard to these subpoenas?
Well, this is an interesting development today, Anderson, and there's no doubt that the committee felt that it was very unlikely that these four men would comply in the way that they're looking for to the deposition and subpoena request that they had put forward. But the fact that we have the former president of the United States, according to the Washington Post in a letter that they review, specifically telling these four men not to comply with the committee's requests because he plans to defend executive privilege. Now, it's not exactly clear how he thinks that he is able to do that and then extend that ability to these four men. There is really a lot of ambiguous legal arguments in that regard. But we should also point out, Anderson, that it's unlikely that even Trump himself can use executive privilege to shield himself from any of information being gleaned from the Select Committee. Most legal experts believe that it is only the responsibility of the current occupant of the White House to take care of and invoke executive privilege, much less extend that to four people, including one person, Steve Bannon, who wasn't even a White House official on the day of the January 6th insurrection. So this is more than anything likely to be a delay tactic by Trump and his allies, because it's going to be a difficult legal battle. And of course, the committee just doesn't have that much time to do their work.
Right. And the courts take time. Ryan Nobles, appreciate it. We're joined now by CNN contributor, former Nixon White House counsel John Dean. So, John, I mean, this strategy is going to work. I mean, the former president, you know, obviously he can't exert executive privilege as he clearly thinks he can. But it doesn't really matter, doesn't it? I mean, this will just end up in courts and will drag on so long that it, other than for history, it may be irrelevant.
That's his goal, is to just gum it up so bad and probably to litigate it. And a lot of these issues are not resolved, Anderson. You're right. There's no way he can say to these people, you cannot testify. You cannot produce any documents in your control. The only sort of range where there is sort of mechanics that we might get to the documents is the Presidential Records Act. If they've complied with it, their records from the White House are in the National Archives. And the archivist is under an executive order written by Barack Obama that tells him what he can and cannot do. And with an incumbent president, he has limited impact on a past president's papers. And if Trump does invoke executive privilege, the archivist is the one who will make the decision in consultation with the attorney general and the White House counsel, as well as under general instructions from the incumbent president. So, but this has never been litigated. We don't know if that executive order is even good. And I think that's what Trump wants to go for. His lawyers have probably told him, you can drag this out for years.
Because there's this reporting from the Washington Post that the former president's lawyer is telling these former aides not to comply with subpoenas from the January 6th committee. Obviously, it's one thing to actually fight a subpoena in court. It's another to completely ignore it at the direction of the former president, isn't it?
He has no authority to do that. Each of those people have to decide what they can do, and they can't say, well, I'm acting under the orders of former President Trump. That's no order. It is meaningless. So they can find themselves in contempt. And Anderson, again, this is where the House has failed to get itself in order to prepare for this. There are remedies for this. There are housekeeping things they can do and make these subpoenas, through their inherent contempt powers, have some meaning.
Well, but why wouldn't they do that if that was a possibility? I mean, what is the inherent contempt power they're talking
Boy,
about?
I don't know. I cannot figure out. It is a no-brainer. Ted Lieu introduced in the last Congress and again in this Congress a resolution that would amend their rules that would give a fine power, the up to $25,000 per incident and up to $100,000 per particular material, which can be repeated again and again. It could really add up. And this is just amending their rules. They don't have to go to the Senate. They don't have to go to anybody. And I just don't get it why they don't brace themselves to deal with this kind of behavior.
How significant are the new subpoenas for this, you know, the so-called Stop the Steal organizers from the January 6th Select Committee? I mean, it's worth noting one of the organizers claimed he worked closely with Republican congressmen in planning the rally at the Capitol. Of course, whether or not he was being honest, you know, who can tell with these people?
I think they're important. I think they're being very thoughtful, the subpoenas they issue. And if these people indeed comply, and I don't know why they wouldn't, they will get more information as to how this thing really came down. And that's what they're clearly trying to get hold of.
Yeah. John Dean, I appreciate it tonight. Thank you. Now, his former Watergate counterpart, in a sense, CNN political analyst, author, and investigative reporter, Carl Bernstein. Carl, thanks for being with us. So the Senate Judiciary Committee report is the most comprehensive look so far at the former president's assault on democracy, asking the Justice Department 9 times to undermine the election result. I'm wondering what your takeaway is it?
Well, that there has been a coup led by the President of the United States to undermine the Constitution and possibly and likely a criminal conspiracy as well. And all of these things that are laid out in the report are uncontrovertible evidence of the President of the United States trying to overwhelm constitutional responsibility, to subvert and evade the laws of the United States and the Constitution of the United States. But I think we also need to look at something. We are looking at an ongoing cover-up led by the Republican Party to keep the people of the United States from knowing what the hell happened in these terrible moments in which the President of the United States, for the first time in our history, tried to subvert a legal and free election. And now we are heading toward the next election in which these same forces are planning to subvert the election. So we are in a constitutional crisis.
You have Chairman Durbin saying we were a half step away. You think we're in it?
We're in it because look toward the next election. Right. Look at what has happened already and look at the country itself. The most significant thing, perhaps, is not just the coup attempt and the coup by the President of the United States and the Republican Party going along with it, but almost half of the adult voters in this country, from all of the polls and what we saw in the last election, are willing to go along with these lies.
Yeah.
So we are in a kind of civil war in this country.
Well, not only voters, the base supporters willing to go along with this lie. You have Senator Grassley's, you know, rebuttal from the GOP saying nothing to see in that meeting, you know, that Trump, oh, he listened to his senior advisors and followed their advice and recommendations. I mean, That's an insane interpretation of an insane meeting which took place with the former president.
Chuck Grassley was once a really honorable man with a terrific record serving his party.
Wow, that must have been a long time ago.
And it is a long time ago because what he is doing is a disgrace, as his colleagues are doing. What the Republican Party is doing today is unprecedented in our history. Going along with subversion of the Constitution of the United States, this is not about a set of unknown facts. It's very clear to these people in the Republican Party what happened. They want to win and prevail in this civil war at any cost. And the cost to the country is something that we have not seen in this nation since 1860 to 65. Yeah. That's the only period in our history we can look at as to when the forces of undemocratic, to say the least, but when the forces gathered to undermine our unity as a country and what we stand for and who we are in a similar period right now in which, and that's what we need to be covering as well in the media. What is going on in the country that is allowing this to happen? We need to find out what's on people's minds that they are willing to go along with this.
Well, also, you know, look, I mean, who hasn't become somewhat numb to this constant assault? And that's, I mean, you know, that's how psychopaths are able to, you know, remain free and you know, yes, succeed in society because they wear down everybody else around them and just are shameless and have no, you know.
Let me say, so you just raised a really interesting point. You used the word psychopath. Let's say that perhaps we have a sociopath or a psychopath who has been the president of the United States and seeks perhaps to be the next president of the United States and has ignited this movement. We have never had a period in our history when 40-45% of the people in our country have said, oh, yeah, I'll go along with this psychopath. I'll go along with this sociopath. We need to be looking at these facts as well as the coup and what this individual did. We need to look at why are our people, so many of our people, following this sociopathic undermining of our democracy. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, it is. There's been a lot of comparisons, obviously, to Watergate, but just looking back to the darkest days of the Nixon administration.
The system worked in Watergate. Richard Nixon left office. He agreed to leave office. He didn't start a coup at the last minute to say, I'm going to stay here. I'm not leaving. Don't let that chopper take off on the lawn. He said, I have to go. He acknowledged that he had to go. Whatever he thought of the facts, he knew that there was a constitutional process in place and that he had lost and that the Supreme Court had made him turn over his tapes and that he was no longer, and he would have been impeached and convicted in the Senate. What made him go was his knowledge that his own party was going to convict him. Now, Donald Trump's party has not convicted him in the Senate, is not about to convict anybody, but rather is intent on covering up this horrible, horrible coup and undermining of our democracy led by this person and now endorsed, enabled by one of our two political parties. We've never had anything like it in our history.
Yeah. Carl Bernstein, I appreciate it. Thank you, Carl. Coming up next, more breaking news, significant new details. Randy Kaye has just learned about what police were doing when Brian Laundrie returned home to Florida without his fiancée, Gabby Petito. And later, the Surgeon General of the United States joining us to talk about some positive trends in the battle against COVID, some good news. We'll ask whether he thinks the worst of the pandemic is actually behind us.
Gabby.
There's some breaking news tonight in the search for Brian Laundrie, who disappeared just days after his fiancée, Gabby Petito, was reported missing. Randy Kaye just spoke with the police in Florida, where Laundrie's family lives and where he was last seen. So I understand you learned some new details, including whether or not police actually spoke with Brian Laundrie when he returned home to Florida without his fiancée.
We did, Anderson, and the answer is no. I'm told by the spokesperson for the Northport Police Department that authorities did not speak with Brian Laundrie before he disappeared. We also learned, and this is also new, that police were surveilling Brian Laundrie before he disappeared. Now, they were doing what they could legally do. I'm told there were some limitations because, remember, there hadn't been a crime at that time. Gabby Petito's remains had not been found yet, so there were some legal limitations to this. But this is how the spokesperson for the Northport Police Department explained it to me.
If you talk to a lot of people who have experience in law enforcement, I mean, the guy goes for a walk in the Carlton Reserve. He's not wanted for a crime. What are we supposed to do? We're going to go tree to tree, following him back through the woods? I mean, it just wasn't there with the information we had in this case.
He also added that there was there has been plenty of effort, plenty of hustle by the Northport Police Department in trying to solve this crime, but no investigation is 100% perfect. But Anderson, we also learned from police today that on September 17th, when Brian Laundrie's parents reported him missing, police, as you know, came to this house here behind me, and I'm told from police that the Laundries would only respond to questions about their son missing, and they had their attorney on the phone. They would not answer any questions about Gabby Petito missing and the fact that she hadn't been found. And I'm told that police thought that behavior, Anderson, was odd.
You also got some new information about the family's cell phones.
Right. Well, as you know, we learned recently that Brian Laundrie had bought a new cell phone after he returned from that trip to Wyoming. He went to a store here in Northport, Florida on September 4th and bought a new phone. So the question was, where was his original phone that was on that trip with him out west? I confirmed today with police that they don't have Brian Laundrie's original phone. Authorities don't have Gabby Petito's phone. Neither phone was in the van that Brian Laundrie returned in from Wyoming to here to his family home on September 1st. But we also spoke with a former FBI agent and attorney who said that even if you don't have the physical phone, there is plenty of information that you could get off. You can still get that information from the records of the phone. You can track the phone. You can check geographic location. So not only would they be able to find out where Gabby Petito was, but also just where her phone was and where those text messages might have been coming from, including these two very bizarre text messages that were sent in late August that her parents don't believe were actually sent by her. Now, I'm also told that these text messages would only stay for a few days. Maybe they would only be stored for a few days, but there's other information that would be stored longer in the cloud. For example, maybe internet searches that she did, which could possibly prove to be very valuable to investigators, Anderson.
And today, Brian Laundrie's father went into that nature preserve with authorities. Is there any detail on that?
He went in early this morning with law enforcement, and we understand from the Laundrie family attorney that he was in there to show them maybe areas in there that Brian frequented, also areas that he and his son had hiked and camped in. But the family attorney released a statement as well later in the day that said there were no discoveries, and hopefully Brian will be located soon, Anderson.
And I just want to double back. When you said that the police were kind of observing Brian Laundrie, obviously you said there are limitations. You know, he wasn't accused of a crime or charged with a crime. Do we know anything more about that? Like, what kind of observations? Were they actually surveilling him? What do we know?
It sounded to me as if it was he was very careful about what he was saying because this is an ongoing investigation. He doesn't want to compromise the investigation, but he did confirm that there was surveillance. It sounded like it was a bit of a loose surveillance where they had some eyes on him, but obviously if they had known, he gave that example of if he was in the Crump Reserve, they weren't going to go tree to tree trying to follow right behind him.
All right, Randy, I appreciate it. Thank you. If Brian Laundrie is alive and he's caught and charged with Gabby Petito's killing, of course, there's the question of what his defense would look like. We're joined now by Mark Amaro, who famously defended George Zimmerman in the death of in the killing of Trayvon Martin. Mark, appreciate you being with us. We should say that Brian Laundrie is officially only wanted in connection with using Gabby Petito's bank card following her death. That said, as a defense attorney, I'm wondering what you make of this case and, you know, the family's involvement, the family's attorney, et cetera. Sure.
Well, I mean, there's so much, but most importantly, there's so much that we really don't know. We know the FBI is being very tight-lipped. We don't even know the cause of death or the circumstances surrounding Gabby's passing. So we have a lot of sort of supposition. Obviously, it's easy to focus blame on Brian because he came home without her and now he's taken off. There may well be good explanations for that. We're going to have to wait and see. But certainly, when you're looking at this case from the outside, you see Brian come home with the family for several days and then sort of out and now seemingly in hiding. It's very easy to point a finger at him, but I would just hope or suggest that we do what all of us in the legal profession are trained to do, which is only follow, you know, the evidence that's actually there and keep the suppositions to a minimum.
Well, obviously, it's, you know, there's a lot of people who are looking at the parents and blaming parents as well. Again, we have no idea what knowledge they had or had. It's important to point out, you know, I think that, you know, we just don't know. It's very easy from the outside on, you know, cable shows for people to be hurling invectives and criticizing and making assumptions. But again, facts actually, you know, do matter still in this world. If Laundry is captured, I mean, what is the conversations between a child and, or an adult child and his parents, are those things which, I mean, is there some obligation for families to come forward, or is just saying, look, I'm not going to discuss anything in this subject matter to police, is that okay?
Witnesses actually don't have an affirmative obligation to come forward necessarily. They're not allowed to do the opposite. They're not allowed to actively interfere with an investigation. They're not allowed to harbor a fugitive. They're not allowed to obstruct justice, even accessory after the fact, which is helping somebody to continue to get away with the crime, you know, the getaway car example. So all of those are things that they cannot do. You know, we also have to look at this. This is never well planned out step by step in the beginning. This is always handled in all of these cases, you know, one small step at a time. Something happened with Gabby. Brian takes off potentially. Then comes home. Mom and dad say something. So these are all small steps. What the family cannot do is do anything to affirmatively interfere with the investigation. And you mentioned, you know, if and when Brian is captured, my hope is for the opposite. My hope is that Brian finds himself good counsel. This needs to be addressed more affirmatively, even with fears that he may have of predispositions against him or concerns with law enforcement, or whatever that might be. This is better to be done in the light of day rather than in the shadows.
Mark O'Meara, appreciate you being with us. Thank you, Mark. It is a pleasure to say this next sentence, which is that nearly all the trends in the U.S. are pointing in the right direction in the fight against COVID right now. We'll talk to the Surgeon General about whether he thinks the worst is behind us, and we'll also ask him about when kids 5 to 11 might be able to get the vaccine after Pfizer today requested emergency use authorization. We'll be right back. There is good news tonight on a number of fronts in the battle against COVID in the United States. Hospitalizations, cases, and deaths are all down. Vaccine mandates, though, still very controversial in some quarters, are significantly increasing the number of people vaccinated. And one of the last big groups yet to be eligible for the vaccine is kids age 5 to 11. That got closer today when Pfizer applied for emergency use authorization for their vaccine to be available to that age group. Certainly a lot to get through. We're very pleased to have the top doctor in the nation joining us, Surgeon General Vivek Murthy. Thanks so much for being with us, Dr. Murthy. So I think a lot of people watching tonight are wondering if the worst of the pandemic is behind us. I always want to, like, knock on wood and even suggesting such a thing. What is your answer to that?
Well, Anderson, I'm certainly cautiously optimistic. And I think whether or not we see another surge of the virus depends in part on what we do to really accelerate vaccination rates. You know, we've seen right now, Anderson, that we've got nearly 215 million people in our country who've had at least one dose of the vaccine. That's pretty extraordinary progress. But when you're dealing with an incredibly contagious variant like the Delta variant, even the people who aren't vaccinated, even though they're a minority of the population, the virus can spread very quickly in that population. So we're thankfully seeing cases and hospitalizations come down, but it's not a reason for us to take our foot off the accelerator or to relax our guard, so to speak. We've got to continue getting people vaccinated because that is our surest way to keep them out of the hospital and to save lives.
Yeah, I actually got my flu shot at CVS today. I was very happy to do that. As the president touted in Chicago today, vaccine mandates, I mean, they appear to be working. According to the White House, in late July, there were 95 million unvaccinated Americans. Now there are 67 million. That said, according to the CDC, more people are actually going in for booster doses than first doses. Is that a good or bad metric in your view?
Well, overall, I think we have made a lot of progress, Anderson. As you mentioned, the numbers of unvaccinated individuals in this country are dropping, and the vaccine requirements are working. We're seeing evidence of that. On average, organizations that put vaccine requirements in place are seeing a 20% plus increase in the percentage of people who are vaccinated. Henry Ford Health System in Detroit, for example, went from 68 to 98% of their employees in compliance with their vaccine requirements when they put those requirements in place. So we know that these requirements work. Here's the other really important thing, Anderson, that I think people don't always appreciate enough, which is that vaccine requirements are not new. We actually have a long history in our country of requiring vaccines in various settings. President George Washington required inoculation against smallpox of soldiers. In the 1800s, we started in schools requiring vaccines. Hospitals, like the ones I've worked in over the years, have long required vaccines, like the flu vaccine that you recently got. in order for people to practice medicine. And this is really about creating a safe environment for people to work, for young people to study, and for all of us to engage in commerce. So these are a good thing. They're going to continue to help us move forward, and it can't come soon enough.
What is the likelihood of some other variant emerging, like the Delta variant, that's, you know, that's worse or easier to transmit to kids, or, you know, some variant? I mean, obviously, that's why they call it a variant. Some, you know, with variable different things about it.
So, Anderson, I'm glad you brought it up, because we do have to be aware and vigilant of the fact that new variants can develop. And the more spread there is of COVID, the more likely those variants will surface. But here's interestingly what we've already seen is over the past 18, 19 months, with all the variants that we've had, Delta, Alpha, and others, the vaccines have actually been remarkably effective at preventing the worst outcomes, hospitalization, severe disease, and death, with all of these variants, which has been actually very, very useful to us. Now, could that change in the future? It's always possible. But that's why we are prepared to modify these vaccines to do what we need to make sure we keep up with COVID-19. But there is no substitute for making sure people actually get the vaccine. You know, the science is working, the production and manufacturing has stepped up, but we need people to actually get that vaccine in order for it to save lives.
So Pfizer formally requested an emergency use authorization for its vaccine for kids age 5 to 11. Do you think the vaccine will become one of the immunizations needed for school next year? I mean, should it be required along with measles and mumps and rubella?
Well, I think there's certainly a case that a number of states have already made. You've heard California, indicate that it will support vaccine requirements for kids when a vaccine becomes available. And I think you're going to see more states move in this direction. You know, vaccine requirements have typically been local and state decisions in terms of which vaccines are required. But I think part of the reason you're going to see more states likely move in that direction post-authorization is because we all want our kids to go back to school, to be able to stay in school, and to be safe. And many people out there think that, you know, COVID's not a big deal for kids. We shouldn't really worry about it. But yeah. I will tell you, we've lost hundreds of children to COVID. Thousands have been hospitalized. And we could prevent a lot of this with a safe and effective vaccine.
Well, also, the idea of my child getting long COVID or some thing that sticks around for, you know, that's awful. When do you think the 5 and up group will be able to start getting shots? And what about the under 5 group?
Yeah, well, I have a personal interest in this for sure, because I have 2 kids who are 3 and 5. I certainly want them to get vaccinated. The fact that Pfizer indicated it has now formally requested authorization is a good sign. The FDA has said that it's going to move in the order of weeks, not months, to get this done. It's already scheduled an advisory group meeting to consider vaccines for children, which is also a promising sign. So I think we're going to see movement very quickly here. But Anderson, one thing the FDA is not going to do is they're not going to cut corners in this process. They want people to know when they make their decision, and if that ends up being in support of a vaccine for kids, that people know that the vaccine is both safe and highly effective. Yeah. I think we'll see vaccines for kids under 5 come not too long after that, because those trials are slightly behind, about another month or so behind. So we've got to wait for the companies to submit that data, but I think that's going to come not too long after.
And just finally, Scott Gottlieb, former FDA commissioner, said on CNBC that he thinks the combination of a vaccine for children and the new antiviral medication from Merck would, quote, bookend the pandemic phase of the virus. Do you agree?
Well, I certainly think it moves us in that direction. Keep in mind, we haven't given as much attention, you know, as a country in terms of our news coverage and, you know, to antivirals as we have given to vaccines, and that's understandable. But we haven't certainly on the federal government side let up our focus on antivirals and on oral medications. And this recent news, telling us that, from the clinical trial conducted by one of the manufacturers, telling us that there is now data that indicates that there may be an oral option that could cut the risk of hospitalization and death in half among people at higher risk of COVID-19. That is incredibly good news. It's got to go through the FDA process. They've got to scrutinize safety and efficacy, but it's certainly a move in the right direction. If we've got good vaccines, we've got good oral medicines, we can use preventive measures like masks when we need them, we will be in good shape against COVID-19.
It's really good news tonight, and I appreciate you being with us. Thank you.
Of course. Thanks, Anderson.
Right,
take care.
Dr. Murthy, thanks. Coming up next, a leading critic of the Texas abortion law joins us now that a federal judge has put the law on hold and clinics are back providing the procedure ahead. The day after a federal judge put the Texas abortion law on hold and the Supreme Court on notice with his 113-page opinion, at least one clinic operator in the state says it's back to providing abortions for women who are more than 6 weeks pregnant, which we should point out has been permitted under Roe v. Wade for nearly 5 decades now. Texas officials indicate they'll appeal the ruling, but they haven't formally asked the Fifth Circuit to put it on hold. I want to get perspective now from former Texas State Senator Wendy Davis. Senator Davis, thanks for being with us. Can you just kind of walk us through what this ruling is now?
Sure. So the judge put an injunction in place, federal district court judge Robert Pittman, enjoining the enforcement of this law and enjoining our state courts and state clerks from accepting the filing of petitions under this law. And while it may seem that all is well, at least for now, as a consequence of that, as we've talked about before, Anderson, there are many pernicious layers to this law. And one of those is the fact that there is a provision in the law saying that if the Fifth Circuit or the Supreme Court stays an injunction, all abortions that are provided during that injunction time period will be considered retroactively to have violated the law. And so there are doctors still on the ground in Texas today, many clinics on the ground in Texas today, that have continued to keep their doors closed. The ones who have decided to move forward, even though they are at risk of retroactive application of the law, are doing so very, very courageously. And they know that they are subject to personal financial risk as a consequence of this. This is the reason that we set up a legal fund for them. If your viewers want to help contribute to it, it's fundthefrontlinetx.org. You can go there and find out more information. We want our healthcare workers to know that we have their back and that they shouldn't feel like they need to be cowed as a consequence of the retroactive provision in this law.
And then just from a legal standpoint, what is the next step? What is the next court to hear this?
So the Fifth Circuit will hear an appeal. The state of Texas has already indicated that it intends to appeal Judge Pittman's injunctive order. They will make a decision on whether that injunction should stand. And it is very likely that the question that they may consider and overturn this injunction on is standing. This was a lawsuit filed by the Department of Justice, and the question will be whether the Department of Justice has the standing to sue in a situation where the state has argued it is not in any way, shape, or form in the role of enforcing this law because they've put it in the hands of private individuals. That will be the question before the Fifth Circuit, and it probably will have that appeal before it very quickly, and I would imagine it's going to make a decision fairly quickly as well. In the meantime, there are people who have been waiting for days and weeks to have abortion care in our state. I am so proud of and impressed by the courage of Whole Woman's Health and some of their clinicians who are trying as best they can in this period of time to provide the care that people have so desperately waited for.
Senator Wendy Davis, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, South Dakota's Republican governor, rising star in the Republican Party, is accused of abuse of power in trying to help her daughter with her career. The state's top law enforcement officer has launched an investigation. We'll tell you what the governor is saying about all that when we continue. Tonight, South Dakota Republican Governor Kristi Noem is facing accusations that she abused the power of her office to help her daughter become a state-certified real estate appraiser. The state's attorney general is now investigating the matter. So are some in the legislature. Noem has made a name for herself in other ways as a staunch supporter of the former president, an opponent of government-ordered COVID mask and vaccine mandates. The question is, will this accusation of nepotism tarnish her national political ambitions or perhaps even a run for the president in 2024? CNN's Lucy Kavanoff reports.
Well, it is such an honor to be with all of you here today.
South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem has been basking in the national spotlight.
People had no idea who I was 6 months ago.
Trumpeting her laissez-faire approach to the coronavirus pandemic.
My people are happy. They're happy because they're free.
I think it's clear that she wants to be president and she intends to run for president in 2024. She spends more time than any governor in recent history has spent out of state. She's inserting herself in issues that don't directly impact the day-to-day lives of South Dakotans.
Now, controversy over a closed-door meeting in the governor's mansion threatens to derail those ambitions. Noam called the meeting on July 27th of 2020 with state officials.
These are my kids, Cassidy.
How's it going?
Married to Kyle.
And her daughter, Cassidy Noam Peters.
Oh, man. Best husband ever.
According to the Associated Press, Peters was facing a denial of her certification as a real estate appraiser when the meeting took place. 4 months later, she got her license, while the woman who oversaw the appraisal program for decades, Sherry Bren, says she was forced to retire. In this age discrimination complaint filed last December, Bren said she was told the reason was her inability to change gears. She settled with the state for $200,000.
Privacy is for individuals, but transparency is for government.
South Dakota Republican Representative Steve Haugard says the meeting flaunts Noam's own campaign promise.
Being transparent, making sure that all public meetings and agendas are posted.
Haugard says any issues with the state's appraisal system should have been handled in the legislature, out in the open.
There's been 3 years of sessions that could have taken place. So that's where it should take place.
Not by some closed-door meeting.
Right.
I never once asked for special treatment for Cassidy.
Noam defending her actions, saying her daughter completed the same requirements as every other applicant, adding that the state's appraisal system needed to be reformed.
It was way too difficult. Appraisers weren't getting certified, and South Dakotans were having to wait much longer to buy a home.
Nepotism in South Dakota's State House.
It's not the first time Noam has been under the microscope over allegations of nepotism, hiring her other daughter, Kennedy Noam, in 2018, fresh out of college.
Kennedy Noam became a policy analyst and her salary rose nearly $10,000.
Governor Noam's office said her daughter was fairly compensated, but government ethicists say Noam's actions in the latest case leave the door open for doubt.
I think we can only hope from the governor that she recognizes that she made missteps in conducting the meeting this way, in involving her daughter in the process, in engaging personally in the process while she had a personal stake. The issue of conflict of interest, the issue of appearance of impropriety remains, and those are problems that I don't think there's a retroactive fix for.
A state legislative committee and the attorney general have announced plans to investigate the July 2020 meeting.
I think she's done an excellent job.
But is it making a dent with voters?
That meeting, I feel like her daughter just shouldn't have been in there at all.
In South Dakota, I think family first type thing. So I think any father or mother would probably try and do something to help her daughter.
Most people that are going to support her are going to support her anyway. And I think people that are looking for a reason to not support her are just going to use that as another reason not to support her.
Lucy, you mentioned the Attorney General's investigating. Where does that stand?
Well, Attorney General Jason Raunsberg, who, by the way, is a political rival of Governor Noam, she has previously called for his resignation. He announced yesterday that he has referred this matter to the state's Government Accountability Board, asking them to investigate the circumstances of that meeting. He's also, in a separate matter, asked that same board to investigate allegations that she may have violated state law, South Dakota law, by using the state plane to fly to events organized by various political organizations. Anderson.
Lucy Kapanoff, I appreciate it. Thanks. A quick programming note before we hand it over to Chris. Princess Diana was obviously a fashion idol, trailblazing activist, an outspoken member of the royal family. There's a new CNN original series called Diana, which gives us all some insight into the princess and reveals a life far more complicated than the world knew. Here's a preview.
I was always different. I had always this thing inside me that I was going somewhere different.
She was going to marry her dashing prince, like all the stories she'd read.
She was iconic. She was box office.
Going to dance with the princess tonight?
She'd like me to.
Pre-Diana, there was zilch interest in the royal family.
I don't think anybody has grown up in public like Diana has.
Diana provided a very public model for defiance and truthfulness.
Isn't it normal to feel angry and want to change a situation?
I was able to recognize an inner determination to survive.
The new CNN original series, Diana, premieres Sunday at 9 on CNN.
That's it for us. The news continues. I want to hand it over to Chris for Cuomo Primetime. Chris?
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.